Hi again, welcome back. Jeff Rentz here, coast to coast and around the world as well on the internet side of things. Hello to all of our broadcast stations around the United States and all of you folks who listen in the archives down the road. We have three terrific guests for you tonight, and I think most of you will realize that not too many days go by when somewhere, somehow on the internet, somebody isn't reporting or talking about underground shelters, underground communication centers, bunkers, underground cities, if you will, for government and continuity. Shadow government has secret underground facilities. We've heard about these things for years. They are a fact of life. We do know the Russians, of course, have spent the better part of half a century now building underground shelters to survive a nuclear confrontation. Not only underground in the urban areas, in fact, there's a large ring of them all around Moscow. So I think about 18 or 20 huge shelters. But the Chinese, of course, and the Russians have gone into and under large mountains with tremendous facilities. We've done the same thing here, but probably not on the large scale that they have, certainly not with respect to protecting you and I at all. Used to be something called civil defense years ago. Maybe you remember that. Now we are left out in the wind to swing. At Richard Sauter's homepage, there is a remarkable picture. I love this picture. It's an underground tunnel with lights and a rail system right down the middle of it. Take a look at that. He has books out that many of you already own, and if you don't, I'd urge you to consider getting them. Underground Bases and Tunnels was the premier issue by Dr. Richard Sauter, and it really got people's attention. He followed that with Underwater and Underground Bases, and we're here tonight to update the whole thing, and I think all of you have heard about how the White House was incensed about a week ago now that somebody had reported where Dick Cheney had been hanging out under some mountains in a major communications center. They felt that that was bad to do, never mind that it was fairly well known. But let's get the details now from Richard Sauter. Welcome back, my friend.
Thank you, Jeff. Glad to be here.
Was the White House, how silly was that?
It was very silly, Jeff. I think even casual readers of the daily newspaper with a good memory would be aware that there is a facility called Site R, which, if you will, is somewhat of an underground alternate Pentagon that's located beneath a mountain on the border between the states of Maryland and Pennsylvania. And it's been used for decades for that purpose. Its name has certainly appeared in the popular press and the mass media many times over the years. Its location is known.
Right.
It's not secret. It's certainly not a secret to the Russians or the Chinese, and hasn't been since it was built.
They probably have 8,000 pictures of the inside of it.
Well, and they certainly have their surveillance satellites focused on it all the time. And if Dick Cheney is going there in a motorcade, they're probably filming him going down the highway to the place.
Sure.
So it was just absurd. It's part of this mindless, I don't know what you would call it, mind
it's
job.
Noise.
That's
noise.
Being run on the American public. I don't even have words to describe the silliness of a PR exercise like that.
I agree.
I think everybody who knows anything in Washington, D.C. at all, whether they're in the press or in government or just a reasonably well-read onlooker, knows that when Dick Cheney goes away and disappears, he's going underground, and some of the places he goes certainly would be, number one, Site R, number two, Mount Weather in Northern Virginia, well-known FEMA bunker, and also deep underground beneath the White House itself, there's an elaborate facility. You know, there's a wonderful little booklet that came out some years ago, written by John Elvin. The title of it is Hogs in the Tunnel.
Hogs in the Tunnel.
Hogs in the Tunnel.
Uh-huh.
It's in tongue-in-cheek. He says the subtitle is an underground classic. John Elvin knows the Washington, D.C. scene. He's a commentator, an observer of events there. And he put this together just dealing with the labyrinth, the warren of tunnels, like a rabbit's warren beneath Washington, D.C., going all the way back to the early years of the Republic. There has been tunneling under Washington, D.C., between government buildings, for getaways, for utility conduits, for sewers, more recently for the subway system. I mean, on and on.
Yeah.
The Congress has their own little subway that takes them back and forth between the office buildings and the Capitol building. There's a tunnel between the Treasury building and the White House. There's all kinds of tunnels beneath Washington, D.C., secret and also publicly known. And what John Elvin did was put together this little booklet discussing this. Hogs in the Tunnel is a tongue-in-cheek title that he gave to his booklet because during the Clinton presidency, evidently, Bill and Hillary liked to step out sometimes at night and party down without having a press corps, you know, following them.
And not always. And not always together.
Yeah, I guess. Although I don't hang out with Bill and Hillary, so I don't know exactly what they do and where they go. But John Elvin presumes to know something about that, and he says that when they did, that they would duck out through some of these tunnels and subterranean levels beneath the White House and enter the other tunnel systems in downtown Washington, D.C., with the Secret Service in tow, of course, but that the Secret Service would let out this cry, hogs in the tunnel, meaning that, you know, Bill and or Hillary are stepping out on the town, albeit incognito, without the limousine.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, and I suspect there may be some truth in that story.
Sure. We also don't want to forget, when you're talking about Dick Cheney, that
yes.
The neighbors were, maybe they still are, complaining about the underground construction at the grounds
well,
of the Naval Observatory.
For those who are not aware of what you're talking about, some time ago, it was about a year or so ago, I guess, there were a few articles that appeared in the news media about blasting that was going on evidently beneath Dick Cheney's house, which is a mansion on the grounds of the Naval Observatory in Northwest Washington, D.C. That's where the Vice President of the United States resides. Al Gore lived there when he moved out. Dick Cheney moved in. And so the neighbors were complaining about this blasting, which evidently resembled the blasting you might find at a rock quarry, for example, or a mining operation. Well, of course, the betting money is that there was some kind of excavation going on beneath the mansion. I doubt if he was just putting in a larger family room in the basement. My money would go on, if I was letting my mind run, knowing what I know about the tunnels that exist under Washington, D.C. This is not rumor. This is fact. There are a lot of tunnels under Washington, D.C. And if I had a guess, I would think that he was putting in either a better elevator or maybe a first elevator connecting his house to one or more of these underground tunnels, the better to make an inconspicuous getaway when he's making one of his trips to Site R or Mount Weather or maybe some other underground facilities we don't know about. But that would be, Jeff, what I would say was going on with that blasting activity.
Sure, sure. I remember reading the stories and kind of laughing about it. I mean, how do they expect to pull something like that off by shaking the entire neighborhood over and over again? I mean,
well, the point is, you can't really hide it.
No chance.
And if you're blasting with dynamite, or probably they were using Tovex. Tovex is widely used in the mining industry these days because it's more stable than dynamite, but you still get a lot of bang for your buck. I believe DuPont makes Tovex, I believe. But it's a very stable and powerful and useful mining explosive, and they were probably using that. But you can't hide it. It does make a big boom. It'll rattle the chandeliers for sure. And people did notice it. It did get into the news. You can't set off large explosions in Northwest Washington, D.C. without people talking about it, and which they did.
One question that comes up often from people is, all right, if they're doing all this underground work, why don't we see piles of dirt topside?
Well, they were in that case, if they were connecting to one or more underground tunnels, as I believe they may well have been, they would have taken the dirt out through the tunnels.
Exactly. All right, very good. Stand by. We are talking with our friend and colleague, Dr. Richard Sauter, Ph.D., about underground tunnels and bases and you name it here in the United States. Be right back. Dr. Richard Sauter, Ph.D., is here. I urge you to visit his website. Lots to talk about. Richard, years and years ago when you were first on the program, we went through underground tunnels and bases and looked at some of the amazing pictures of tunnel boring machines. And these were, I think, circa, well, early 70s, some of them. And
Well, you know, the technology has advanced, but even the stuff that was first made back in the 50s and 60s was very impressive and powerful. These machines have become more sophisticated, more powerful as material science and engineering have advanced as the decades have gone by. But people have to understand these machines are very large. They're extremely powerful. They're very long. They can be hundreds of feet long, 100 feet long, and they are for the most part run off of electricity, and they're expensive, but not as expensive as you might think. If you wanted to buy one of these machines, you could probably get a very nice one for just a couple million dollars.
No kidding.
They don't cost billions of dollars. You might even be able to find a reasonably good used one for less than a million. Of course, you know, once you buy the machine, you're going to have a big shipping charge to send a machine that weighs tons and tons and tons, and that's hundreds of feet long. You'll have to send it by rail or disassemble it and pack it on flatbed trailers or something like that. So you'll spend many thousands of dollars moving it to where you want to use it.
So we bring our machine in pieces and reassemble it.
Well, then you got to hire people who really know how to operate this machine.
Right? Engineers. And then the big question, where can we dig?
Yeah, well, then you run into the question of property rights. Do you legally have a right to bore a tunnel? Where are you going to bore it? And then once you're actually boring the tunnel, you run into other problems and expenses. You have to, what do you do if you encounter groundwater, for example? Mm-hmm. You have to support the tunnel as you go along. If you run into rock that's not well consolidated, you may have to put a tunnel lining on it. You have to bring in ventilation, electricity. You have to run rail for your system and to bring your muck out that you excavate. So there's a lot of other expenses and problems involved besides just buying the machine. So unless you're independently very wealthy, you wouldn't want to buy one of these by your lonesome.
Nah, I think we should just hire one.
Yeah, you'd want to hire one for sure, and you'd want to hire guys. Mining and this type of industry is mostly man's work. I don't want to say there are no women involved, because there certainly are female engineers and women working in underground excavation these days, but it still is, for the most part, a man's game. And you will certainly want to hire a crew that knows what they're doing, because if you run into problems deep underground, you want people down there who know how to resolve them.
Yeah, gee, what if you run into somebody else's tunnel?
Well, you know, that I've pondered that. And, of course, the more tunnels that are made, the greater the likelihood becomes that that's going to happen. And I've wondered if that has happened and what transpired when that took place. Suppose, just for the sake of example, hypothetical example, you have one clandestine tunneling program that's highly compartmentalized, you know, deep black, 2,000 feet underground, and you're tunneling along, and you run into another deep black program tunneling along in the opposite direction. What do you do?
You hold a ceremony and drive the golden spike.
I don't know what happens. But what if that has occurred? You raise an interesting question. I wouldn't rule it out.
Here's another question that people love to knock around, and that's, let me just ask you, do you think that it is likely that there are deep underground tunnels, or even moderately deep underground tunnels, that stretch many, many hundreds of miles, linking key points, maybe even transcontinental tunnel systems?
Yeah, you know, this question has come up again and again, and there have certainly been rumors along this line for years. This was one of the things that got me involved in this line of research, and I still cannot definitively resolve that question one way or another. I can't say, yes, these tunnels definitely do exist. On the other hand, I can't say, no, they definitely do not. For me, this remains an open question to be further researched.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you that what I have found out is that there certainly are discussions out there in the literature, in the tunneling literature, generated by government agencies themselves, dealing with precisely this question of constructing tunnel systems that are hundreds of miles long, deep underground, both in the western states and also on the eastern seaboard. I will tell you as well that I have found patents and also documents generated by the government agencies themselves discussing making hundreds of miles long tunnel systems very deeply buried.
Right.
So this is something that government has certainly considered, not only the military, by the way, but also the U.S. Transportation Department.
Very good.
And others.
Yeah.
So we can talk about that a little more after the break if you
good.
Want. But
sure.
That is certainly an open question that is government engineers and researchers have also devoted some time to.
I bet they have, and I bet there are lots and lots of tunnel systems. It's my personal feeling. We'll be right back with Dr. Richard Sauter in just a few minutes. When you think about it, black projects, as they are called, with, of course, unlimited funding for decades and decades and decades, would clearly be prime territory for people who wanted to go underground. And I believe they have, and I think Richard does too, and I believe they have in a major way. And what we know probably is, a scratch on the surface of what's really under there.
Yes, Jeff, I think that my research represents just the tip of the iceberg. I too would give you better than 50% odds that there are tunnel systems beneath North America and other parts of the world that we know nothing about. I'm also inclined to believe I would give you better than 50% odds that there are very high-speed transit systems underground that we know nothing about. The reason I say that is because I have seen these systems discussed again and again, in patents, in articles that I've uncovered, articles and documents I've uncovered in my research. Certainly government agencies, and it's not only the military, by the way, and also and private industry that interact with these agencies, have been discussing these concepts and plans for decades now. And as you observed, given the size of the black budget, which actually runs into the trillions of dollars, There is certainly plenty of money available there to carry out virtually any civil engineering project that you want. Now, having said that, let me give your listeners an idea of some of the kinds of technology that I believe may possibly be employed in these tunnel systems that I suspect probably exist. Mind you, I can't prove they do,
right,
but I think there's a good chance they do. There was an engineer named Hermann Kemper who took out a Reichspatent in the 1930s. This would be in Germany, during the days of the Third Reich. And he took this out for an invention, a train, if you will, that he called die Rohrbahn. And what this was essentially a magnetic levitation train. Mind you, this was in the 1930s. And the train was to run at a very high rate of speed through a tube from which the air would be evacuated, a long vacuum tube, a vacuum subway, in essence. And the speeds that he was discussing were quite rapid. The number of the patent is 643316, and in fact, you can get this from the German Patent Office. I myself obtained the patent from them. There's an article written by a German journalist named Felix Viper, which appeared in the online news journal Generalanzeiger, in which Felix Viper, who's the editor, by the way, I believe, says that not only was this train designed to go fast, but really, really fast, up to 3,000 kilometers per hour, which is in the neighborhood of 1,800 miles per hour, which, by the way, is hypersonic. But in the absence of any air, there would, of course, be no air friction. This would be riding on a magnetic field. Now, mind you, this patent was cited in the discussion of the literature by the ThyssenKrupp conglomerate that built the magnetic levitation train that's now in being used in Shanghai, between the airport at Shanghai and downtown Shanghai in China. It was built for the Chinese by the Germans, by ThyssenKrupp. And this patent by Hermann Kemper was cited as the prior art and the current magnetic levitation train now in operation in China built by the Germans was based on Hermann Kemper's work back in the 1930s. Come to fruition now. I believe that that train can hit speeds of, you know, something in the range of 200 to 400 miles per hour. I am wondering if the real good stuff is not actually zooming along deep underground,
uh-huh,
and maybe has been for many years, while the Model A's and the Model T's are, you know, just clunking along,
right,
at the slow speed, mind you, of 300 or 400 miles per hour in Shanghai, China. You follow me, Jeff?
Sure do.
That is what I'm wondering. And whether now we're not going to maybe see more of these in use. For example, a line has been in planning for some years now between Amsterdam, I believe, and Hamburg. Amsterdam, of course, being in Holland,
mm-hmm,
and Hamburg being the well-known German city in northern Germany. And so these trains may begin popping up now. The one in China may just be the first. But I'm willing to bet if we're seeing 400 miles per hour topside,
mm-hmm,
that's for use by the peasants and the serfs. I think the really good stuff may well be zipping along at a very high rate of speed, as Hermann Kemper envisioned all the way back during the days of the Third Reich, back in 1934, 35, 36, 37. His patent was issued by the Reich's Patent Office in 1937.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, you remember I sent you the Fate magazine story on...
Well, actually,
on
I have that magazine, Jeff.
Oh, good.
And I believe you're referring to the article by Paul Stonehill about,
correct,
the secrets of the Reagan Wurmlager.
Correct.
Paul
That's
Stone
fascinating.
Hill, for those who don't know, is a very good researcher who for years has been researching the military-industrial complex of the former Soviet Union and also is knowledgeable about the technology developed by the Nazis back in the 30s and 40s, 1930s and 40s, that is. And he wrote a very interesting article about a tunnel system that the Nazis built under what it would now be Western Poland, but back in the 30s and first part of the 40s, it was part of the Third Reich and part of the country Germany. After World War II, the territory passed into the control of the Soviets and ultimately became part of Poland. But the Germans, during the Third Reich, built this elaborate tunnel system there for ostensibly for military purposes, and it runs for miles and miles. We're not talking 2 or 3 miles, but 40, 50 miles or more. It's very elaborate and fairly deep, 100, 150 feet in a lot of places with intersecting tunnels and connections to the surface.
Right,
that's quite fascinating, but it shows you mm-hmm. the state of the art for German technology decades ago, back in the 1930s.
That's right. And some of those tunnels actually are now flooded. One of them at least went under a lake, and there were
yes.
allegedly larger extensions off of it, laboratories, who knows what. And it appears that the SS or whomever flooded those tunnels when they retreated. No one apparently has been in them, at least from what Paul Stonehill was able to find out.
Well, I guess it's hard to go in if they're full of water.
Yeah, it is. All right, hold on. Be right back in just a few. Back with Richard Sauter. We're talking about underground tunnels and bases and all kinds of things. And when you think about it, that is where the elite would want to be and where they are making plans and have been making plans for the better part of a century to be. I mean, when you go back and look at what the Germans were doing, as Richard was just saying, in the late 1930s and 40s, I mean, those tunnel systems were, and there are some pictures of them, they're amazing. And that, again, was what, 75 years ago now, Richard, at least.
Yeah, it's been a little while. I suspect that there may have been systems like that elsewhere, that the powers that occupied German territory after the war probably took possession of and converted to their own use. And I would suspect that systems are much more sophisticated than that and more deeply buried have been built and are probably in use. One of the things I'm wondering, Jeff, is just how many people are down there and whether they all are at liberty to freely come and go. I'm wondering, you know, with these stories we had in the news in recent days of an unknown number, for example, of secret prisons run by the United States around the world, where an unknown number of people are incarcerated for unknown reasons, under unknown conditions. I'm wondering if any of those facilities may be underground or undersea. And the answer to that is we simply do not know. There's a tremendous amount of secrecy surrounding this entire question. This is an issue that I have mused about and pondered since my research first began. There are so many people that disappear, not only in this country, but around the world every year, seemingly just vanish into thin air. Some of them unquestionably run away. Some of them get lost and don't want to be found. Some are kidnapped. Some fall prey to criminal elements and are murdered, for example. But it appears that some of them just more or less disappear, and the And there isn't a satisfactory explanation for their whereabouts or what happened to them. I am wondering if people are shanghaied, so to speak, and pressed into slavery or involuntary servitude underground. I cannot answer that question, but I've been wondering about that ever since I began my research. And now that we have these stories that are appearing in the news just in recent days about secret American prisons where people are being secretly incarcerated, an unknown number of them, by the way, and we don't know who these people are, this raises this question anew. We've entered a very troubling, disturbing period in American history. It appears we are rapidly morphing, we the American people and this American government, whatever it is, into some kind of dictatorial regime where bad things happened, and it disturbs me, Jeff.
Well, it disturbs me too. I mean, this is a big issue.
It's a huge issue.
Yeah.
And I think we, all of us, each and every person listening to this program, need to make it our business to think about these questions and discuss them, because who's to say that Jeff Rantz or Richard Souder or any other individual listening to this program couldn't also fall prey to these monsters who are just grabbing people off the street and disappearing them?
How many people disappear each year in the U.S.?
And you know,
certainly,
that's hard to say.
Nobody knows. There's no census for it.
No, there is. There's no census of that. Yeah. I can say with confidence from my own research, which is by no means exhaustive, but just from a smattering of articles that I have collected from the general news media, just from newspapers in the last 10 years or so, there's no question that thousands of people disappear in this country every year. Now, how many thousands would that be? 5,000 or 50,000? The astonishing thing is, as you observed, no one knows, and no one is keeping rigorous statistics on it.
I don't think anybody really wants to know.
No, because it's one of the great, you know, hot third rails of American public policy that goes virtually undiscussed. At one time, we had the missing children on milk cartons, but they've kind of been put on the back burner these days, too. But it's not only kids, by the way, Jeff. It's people of all racial groups, all ethnic groups, both genders of all ages, who just disappear.
Right.
In large numbers. Where are they going? What's happening to them? This is not discussed in our society. It is a very difficult question to research. People don't talk about it.
Yep. Very good point. A lot of them turn up, a lot of them don't. And again, a lot of them don't.
Yeah. Sometimes people turn up, they just ran away, they wanted to get lost, maybe they kidnapped the kids because the spouse, you know, they had a falling out with their spouse or whatever. But after you account for all of that, there's still a residual number that can't be found. And the body doesn't turn up, for example. So what's happening to them? It's almost impossible to say. But we do know we have this underground activity, and now we do know, because of these reports in the news media in recent days, that there are these secret prisons that the United States government and military are maintaining, and we don't know who's in them. We don't know how many people. We don't know where they are. We don't know the terms of their imprisonment. It raises many troubling questions about what does it mean to be an American? What is the United States government really doing? And where? And why?
Mm-hmm.
It's all out of control, man.
It is indeed, and it's almost every day we seem to be confronted with, I don't know how it can be, but we see a new dimension. Those of us who watch, a new wrinkle, a new angle to the this hurtling towards some kind of a very unpleasant conclusion.
I think what we're looking at, Jeff, is a red, white, and blue criminal syndicate.
I think it boils down to that.
Yeah,
it's certainly an appropriate concept to entertain.
How else, for example, if the mafia grabs someone off the street and says, you know, you guys can't know what we're doing, federal prosecutors charge them with kidnapping. So what does it mean when the U.S. Marines or the FBI or whoever these contractors are who are running around the world under contract to the government these days, when they grab somebody off the street, what is that? I submit to you that that is also kidnapping, and it is also a capital crime under Anglo-American jurisprudence. And when it's done by the government or under the auspices of the government, I submit that what you're dealing with there is a red, white, and blue criminal syndicate that is involved in mass kidnapping. And it's out of control.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know any other way to explain it. Is it okay to kidnap? I don't think so.
No.
But it's taking place. We don't know who's being kidnapped. We don't know where they are. We don't know how many there are. We don't know the conditions of the detention.
And
we only know that it is taking place because we've had these admissions in recent days, which are very troubling and startling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the American people need to make it their business to find out what's happening, or else, you know what? Maybe it's going to be you. Maybe it's going to be me. And then we'll wish we had made it our business.
Getting America to wake up and assert itself as a public seems impossible.
Well, we have to do it one at a time. Instead of thinking, well, we're going to do all 280 million or 300 million at one time. It's like anything else. We don't need to awaken just one person. I'm not saying I'll be happy if I can just awaken one person. No, I won't be happy until all 300 million wake up, and they need to. It's not enough for just one or two to wake up, but it is imperative that we do wake up by ones and by twos and by threes and fives and tens and by thousands and ten thousands and a hundred thousands and millions. And we got to start it right now, not 10 years from now, right now, today, this evening. Because if we don't, I don't think the future is very bright, Jeff. The future can be bright, but only if you open your eyes. You can only see the sunrise if you open your eyes.
It's like,
if you keep your eyes shut, it's always going to be midnight.
Sure. Ignorance has never been more blissful for so many people.
Well, all I
don't mean
say
to say,
is,
maybe
if this
blissful
is the
wrong
call
word.
Right now, then wake up and hit the floor running because
yeah.
time is
well, time is
a
almost
wasting.
Gone. Yeah, it may not be bliss, but ignorance is at least a semblance of security for a lot of people. They'd rather not know. And you know, even it's sad to see intelligent people, Richard, and you see them, I see them, who are certainly equipped to handle and process many of the realities which we deal with, who choose not to.
Well, and, Jeff, but I guess if they are not able to handle and process and deal with reality as it is, then maybe they're not very intelligent after all.
Maybe not. Good point.
And I would say, I know that the hour will soon be up, that the bottom line is, my research certainly indicates, going back for decades, a very great interest on the part of many government agencies and many large corporations going underground and deep underground and making lengthy, deeply buried tunnel systems. And I might add, it's not only the Americans. It was the Germans back in the 1930s, for God's sakes. It's certainly the Russians doing it, the Chinese
big time.
The English, the French, the Swiss, the Norwegians, the Israelis, I mean, on and on. The Japanese are some of the world's great underground excavators.
Right. Well, it's said, Richard, that Berlin and the time of World War II, for every one square meter that was built above ground, there were, I think, two underground that were built. So, yeah. It's an amazing topic. Thanks for being here. It's always fascinating, and we'll be here if you need any more airtime for any of this. Just let me know.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Take care.
Yes, sir.
Richard Sauter, and his books are eminently fascinating. You look at the patents in his books. Look at the pictures in the Underground Bases and Tunnels book. Just it'll tell you the story. We'll be back